This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
6 months now since Nancy Guthrie was taken from her bed in Tucson. No arrest, no named suspect, a homicide classification, but nothing to show for it. Days ago, Savannah Guthrie posted the most targeted language she's ever used in a public plea. Words that suggest something is happening behind the scenes that the rest of us may not be seeing. Savannah posted a video days ago saying, "I know you have tried to do things the right way. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her." Why? Why this new video? That's where we're going to start this morning. We welcome your thoughts in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, wherever you're watching us. Comment away. We'll watch for those. We'll begin our conversation here. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent with us, along with, of course, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Jen, you have been the most comprehensive coverage person I know on the Nancy Guthrie case. What's your take? Why this new video from Savannah pleading, "I know you have tried to do things the right way. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her." What's your take?
Well, I think for me, and I know a lot of my colleagues disagree. They still say these notes aren't real. They're not legitimate, meaning they're not from the abductor. That's what we mean by real.
Yeah.
I can't find one iota of information that doesn't show they're real. People like to say they're not real because they say, "Oh, it doesn't seem like what we've normally seen." Well, that's a pretty crappy reason to say they're not real. Look at the response by the FBI, and now look at exactly what you're pointing to. Another response that I believe is aided by the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit related to the language they're having her use, particularly in response to letter two. That is an apology letter, not really a ransom letter. They don't ask for money. And that's what I think this specific language talks to, because they're apologizing. And she's trying to say, "I get you. You tried to do things the right way. And you still have a chance to basically right this wrong."
Is this a response literally to like the note from almost 6 months ago now? Or do you think there's more notes being sent behind the scenes here that we're unaware of?
I don't think there's any more notes or any more contact beyond note number two, which came in on the 6th. The reason I think it's coming out now, though, Tony, which is a very important reason. Number one, 6 month mark, but she sent this before the 6 month mark, really. The other reason is because of that Reuters report that just tried to deep six those. The Bureau came back in their strongest of any retort we've ever seen written, saying, "No, we're still looking at some of those notes," and making that crystal clear. And then all of a sudden, on the heels of that, Savannah comes out, and I think they're trying to reinforce and trying to hopefully reach somebody who knows who Porch Guy is.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Jen, with the language Savannah used, matching the language of empathy and tone that especially that second letter struck. And I'm curious about this because I know other people are weighing in on this as well, because this kind of goes to the original theory that I've been working on, and that the abduction was plan B. And I know and that's why I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because the language used, and I know this is probably why Reuters, I don't want to speak for them, but others are saying that they're skeptical of the first two notes. Well, I think they're skeptical because they don't fit the mold of someone who's actually using her as the primary reason and way to get money. It was an afterthought, because what they were hopefully going to do in there went sideways, plan B, because this is not written by someone who does abduction or has done it before or really planned it out. What are your thoughts on that, seeing the full notes?
So I still have not waned in my conviction that this was a planned, targeted abduction for money. And I think that the reason the awkwardness of these notes, I'm very convinced, is they are AI driven and AI created with particular prompts, probably from somebody who is not a native English speaker. So that's where we see perished and we see US dollars and we see the sentence structure of the time and the date that they want the money. And we see the R-E-C-E-I-V-E-D received spelled wrong on just one occasion because I gets confused. And so it went I-E. That's not what normal people do. People, human people, when are there any other kinds of people? When we make an error, we repetitively do it. We spell received wrong all the time. And so I truly believe these notes are AI generated and aided, and that's why they seem so awkward.
So my follow-up to that, you know, I'm curious, how do you think they were able to then create that second note? Because if you are, say you're using AI driven for the first note, which is very kind of matter of fact, specific and a little more tactical and strategic, less empathetic, how do you go then from that and demanding money on the first one? What do you think they were doing then if they're using AI to use empathy and a sympathetic approach on the second one where they're not asking for money? Just kind of seeing how you're thinking they thought through that.
I love this question, Robin, because when I was away this week teaching in between self-defense class and shooting classes, I was toying with exactly how you do that. And it all comes down to the prompt. Make an empathetic apology note for killing the person you kidnapped.
So, and I get that. So that's my question. What do you think prompted them to take that more empathetic approach versus the first one?
Oh, because they were in a crap load of trouble when they realized she died. They could not keep her alive. They mentioned that they think it is even a heart issue. It also tells me that they weren't close to her, close enough to know she had a serious heart situation, which you would never know that about Nancy watching her on the Today Show in November or other times. I mean, she looks like actually an 84-year-old that gets around pretty good. Right. So now she's dead. And now if and when you get caught, you already have, as you know, this is huge in we see it in criminal matters for sure, self-serving statements. You see them throw it out there. They'll send things to to the family members, basically apologizing for things in advance of possibly getting caught. So then you can say, listen, I meant to kidnap her. I certainly didn't want to kill her.
And one more follow-up, because I know, Tony, I'm hogging all your air.
You're fine.
So the first one, so basically what you're saying there, and I agree that they could be using that second letter for, you know, for mitigating if they're caught. Yeah. So basically what we're saying then is they gave up after the first letter. Is that typical that they'd give up or would they try not, wouldn't they try to get some sort of money for returning her body, for giving leads on how to get there? I mean, because it went from, if we're going on that theory, it went from 100 miles an hour to trying to get ransom for her to I completely gave up in the second letter. Is that normal, or what you'd expect?
Another great question. So initially when I was really looking at the wrench possibility, meaning a more organized and a criminal group that would have gotten a mope to do this, and I'm still, I'm a little bit there still, but if it's the more homegrown variety that ended up targeting her and then did this to her, I think they are terrified of getting caught, facing the death penalty. It's not worth it to them anymore. It's like, I'm out. My life is not worth it, and I'll go kidnap somebody else.
And you answered the question about, I was curious about what you thought about the wrench attack at this point, too. So you got that one in there, too. Thank you. I'm done.
If you opened up a door here with the idea that these notes were AI written, which they very well could be, We don't know that, but you're right. I mean, there's a lot of signs here that this was in some way machine created, if you will, to some degree. Not to say somebody's not behind it saying, communicate this, and then it wrote it. Here's a thought, and I'm wondering if it's been run down anywhere. Can we reach out to there's obviously a lot of AI companies out there, but there's quite a few that are commonly used, OpenAI, you know, ChatGPT, Grok, Claude. There's several within the U.S. that I'm wondering, Just as if someone makes a search inquiry into Google, Google registers that someone searched for that at some point in time, and that can be looked back of, look, some there is this amount of search history for this name or whatever at a certain time. I am wondering, and I don't know the answer to this question, if they were to reach out to one of these companies or all these companies going, look in your database of information and see where and when this specific text was created within your system, and let's figure out the IP behind it and who created it and where. Not just people, because I mean, tons of people are going to throw this into AI, but not that. Where was it? Where's the first instance of this pattern of these words, this note showing up in your system, and how who generated it? There's going to be a user behind it. There's going to be an IP behind it. It may lead to a VPN. It may lead absolutely nowhere. But I'm thinking that may be a loose end where somebody who's making this note is not necessarily thinking, gee, I better do this behind a VPN.
Well, I can't imagine that the Bureau hasn't looked into this. I really just can't. That they wouldn't have issues.
There's a lot of things I couldn't imagine not happening here. But so
you never I'm know
just, that's
fan.
Why I don't know. I'm just
and
throwing
you know,
it out there.
It up. I'm looking it up right now.
And we still don't even have billboards. But nevertheless, yeah, absolutely, Tony. Can it be done? I think it can. It would be such a needle in the haystack where you really use this is after you have your perpetrator and then you look through their, you know, digital footprint. But this is the problem with that. We clearly are dealing with somebody that is using advanced cover-up methods, whether that's VPN, whether that's public internet, or whether that is using foreign, like Proton-type accounts. Yeah. There's all of this. And so this person, if they're savvy enough, I would be literally doing this at Starbucks, where it's Starbucks.
But oh, wow. even so, you're going to get a user on that. You're going to get an IP of a device. I mean, again, it could be VPN, but I don't know. That seems to me like, you know, I get, you know, you're going to hide it when you're doing crypto and that sort of stuff and trying to get money. But right in the note, I don't know. I mean, that could be something that nobody thought to VPN because you're not necessarily, you know, hiding it as you're generating it. I don't know. I'm curious. Robin, what are you finding in your research over there?
So it can be done. AI companies, OpenAI, ChatGPT, Anthropic, Claude, Google, Gemini, XAI/Grok, yeah. Microsoft, they all can do that. So practical limitations, retention windows matter, anonymous use is harder. Companies require a valid legal process. But with a subpoena, they actually can do that. So investigators believe the letter shows signs of AI generation. They can and likely would pursue warrants to major AI providers seeking prompts. And I made sure I made the request specific for a time period. So it can be done. And I would imagine, you know, because we're talking about, you know, sophistication as an individual, and I wholeheartedly agree with Jen. This guy is a mope, whether used by someone else or he himself. And I can't imagine there was a huge amount of subterfuge if AI was used to create those things. So it's a matter of where they created it from. But I think if they could narrow down, like, I would start with a 100-mile radius, and I'd start with that time period, and I'd plug it in and see what they came up with first, and then just keep expanding from there.
Are we still seeing a lot of miscommunication or not communication here between Nanos and Patel? Because you got Nanos this last week saying that Patel is misinformed and his public statements are hurting the case. I don't understand how that's even possible 6 months into this where we have no anything. And the person who said a lot of contradictory shit was not necessarily Kash Patel. It was Nanos. What do you see going on there in terms of two agencies cohesively working together to try and get somewhere on this?
Well, at the top level, they haven't even met.
Yeah.
So they have no communication. They have no interaction. They're not sharing text messages. This is clearly a situation where, and you know, it was kind of interesting because, and I couldn't believe Nanos did this. He said something to words to this effect. You know, well, Kash Patel's a busy guy. He's got a big agency to run like me. I've got, you know, 1,200 or so employees. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, he may not really understand how big the bureau is.
That's half the size of New York field office when I was there.
I know. That's what he was saying. He's like, he's an important guy. And then immediate shift, which I haven't been as hard on Nanos, I don't think, as some people have. I've really tried to give him some, you know, grace. And every time I say, okay, listen, you know, he's in charge, let's give him some grace. And then he releases the Bitcoin address. And then he says the FBI doesn't know what they're doing. And I'm like, oh gosh, Nanos, just stop.
You know, and I was talking to Tony and Todd before we started on this with my impression of Nanos when he came on again. And I've been the same, Jen, because, you know, for people in these positions, you want to give that grace because no one's perfect. But here's my major problem that keeps evolving more and more every time he speaks. And that is he has zero depth of field of this investigation. This is far and wide the most important investigation now in his department, if not ever in his entire career. And yet when he speaks, he does not speak with definitive language. He doesn't speak with definitive facts, details, or anything. It's very subjective, broad sweep. I mean, anytime you listen to him, it's like someone asks him a question, he's like, oh, wow, we're covering that case. I got to get on my boys to figure out what's going on. I mean, that's literally the way he comes across. A little too casual, a little too not detail knowledgeable. And I think that's what's eroding the trust on this is we're not hearing from anyone, bureau side, sheriff side, or anywhere that seems to have a definitive knowledge on what the hell is going on. I mean, we got more knowledge from watching Savannah and theorizing about at least the BAU's involved because it looks like there's some good effort put on in that letter. And that's it. Everything else is so subjective and it's very lacking of detail, I think.
How about this, you guys? How about the fact that he didn't even know Derek Colella wasn't sentenced?
Yep.
He didn't know his name.
That's what I'm talking about.
He literally threw out, he goes, that California boy, I think is how he said it. Seriously.
Yep.
He might have said fella, but I think he said that California boy found out that that people are going to be prosecuted if you send extortion letters or words to that effect. And then he said he got 10 years. I was thinking, he doesn't know his name. I mean, it's bad when a podcaster and a sleuth on the internet know more than the sheriff.
Yeah.
About the tentacles of this case. I am dumbfounded.
Everyone
as
does.
To how that could happen.
And that's what I like. And that's that depth of field thing. If you can't demonstrate depth of field as much as a podcaster, as much as us, I mean, Jen, you know this, every time, not just prepping for Tony's show, I mean, it's an hour long. That's a lot of work to get depth of field of all the cases. But even when we're doing like a Fox or News Nation news hit for 4 to 6 minutes, it's hours and hours and hours of research that you're doing to make sure you have depth of field for anything that might come at you so you don't sound like an idiot like he does.
It's like he's not even trying. It's
yeah, exactly.
Like,
he's not even trying.
Oh, there's a mic. Okay, I'll go talk.
Like, I got this.
It's like just phoning in his job. Like what are we? Let me ask you this. Are we looking at this from an angle because this is a huge case, at least publicly, in terms of interest. But people go missing every day in the United States, and the FBI gets involved, and local jurisdictions get involved, and there's not this level of coverage to it. Had Nancy Guthrie not been Nancy Guthrie, had she just been, you know, Nancy, you know, Jones, and her daughter wasn't Savannah Guthrie, is this... would we be expecting the FBI director and the local sheriff to be having a conversation? Are we expecting too much out of this? Not that they couldn't be doing more, but are we putting too high of a bar on this? This is going to get all of this attention and this is going to get all of these resources. Nancy's another person in the country of a lot of missing people. Are we putting too much weight on the fact that of the attention this case is getting just because it's a famous person, if you will?
Well, I mean, you just made the point right there. The horse done left the bar.
Yeah.
It's already to this level that you had on day very shortly after. I can't remember the exact day. The president of the United States addressing the Nancy Guthrie case after he was briefed. You have Kash Patel that's come out on 3 different shows that I've watched,
yeah,
where he talks about his knowledge of the case, which is, I agree with you, it's unusual, but it's, that's where we're at, and he's involved. And so you would never expect Kash Patel to be in the weeds like he is on any of these cases. We've never seen that before. It started with Comey. It did start with Comey, I'll tell you that, getting in the weeds on cases. But Sheriff Nanos, he is the sheriff. It's on him to know all these details. And if he doesn't, put your detective up there. And did you hear there was a detective change?
No.
There's another
one. I need to put that out.
Yeah. And so I get it. And we talk about this a lot on the show with the cases that get attention and the cases that don't and the families that feel like they've been left behind and those that don't. And I get all that. But the sheriff and us don't choose what that grabs the interest of the American people. And when it does, that's their job. Because part of what you do as a leader is you maintain the trust and confidence of your population, of the people at large and the nation at large, that we can keep you safe, that justice is going to be served, and the public chooses what case they want to pay attention to, and your job is to demonstrate that you can do that, not just for this case, but that means we could do it for all the cases, and that's what he's failing on, I think, in my estimation.
Yeah. It is, and he got off on the wrong foot when he decided to go to a basketball game, like on day two. No one does that when the bell rings. Did you... that is the term my boss always used. Guys, the bell's rung. That means drop everything, and you're going to spend all of your time on this until I unring the bell. I don't know if that was a phrase you heard, or it's because I had a Hooverite supervisor, Dick Ludwig. But man, when the bell rings, you don't get to even go to a kid's birthday party. You're stuck working on that case until the bell unrings.
Yeah. And that does happen. And we've seen it. And I'm sorry, Tony. And we've seen it when Koberger's case, when they first made the first statements there, they're stumbling on themselves. And down in Nolan Wells's case, the sheriff, same thing, too quick to say it wasn't foul play is being ruled out. And what did both of those people do after they backtracked, they shut up, they readjusted, they reengaged, they got someone else in there, they adjusted, they learned from their mistakes, and they're marching forward to do what? Maintain a trust and confidence of the people around them, to support them, to get the leads in, and Nanos is doubling down on stupid. I mean, we're talking about, isn't he getting a loving critic in his life weighing in on him, you know, saying, but it doesn't matter. If you're not taking the information in, anyone, you know, the world could be telling you what to do, but if you think you got it because you're smarter than everyone else, you're not going to adjust.
Do you think Nanos is really the type of human being who has loving critics in his life? Who allows loving critics in his life? I mean, he seems to be more like, you criticize me, you're just not going to be part of my conversation.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. So, exactly. It's like, I think it's kind of, he shuts out, this is my conjecture, shuts out anybody. He seems like he's surprised he's the sheriff every time I see him. It's like, oh, I'm the sheriff today. I better, my words matter. I'm not used to that. Like, literally the shit he said. Like, yeah, I mean, that's why it matters who you vote for. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to have our conversation about the Nancy Guthrie case. Let's go over to Brian Koberger. He has filed to withdraw the guilty plea he entered for the murders of Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. The whole filing leans on what was recovered from the victim's hand, and almost nothing being reported about it seems very accurate. Retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer is with myself and retired FBI Special Agent Robin Dreek today. As we break down where this is at, let's start with what the claim is, and it's from the broken plea book, basically. He's citing what the author cited. It's not from an actual report. The FBI lab took debris from Ethan Chapin's hand. The word they used was debris, not clumps of hair. That was in a book that was written. That's not part of the actual report. So I think that's important to understand, number one. But Koberger doesn't quote the actual police report. He quotes a book and says, see, See, look at that. That must be something here. They compared it against one person on Earth, Brian Koberger, and wrote down that none of it matched him. One of the strands matched Ethan's own hair. The rest, we don't really know, wasn't matched to anybody. Then the report says the rest was preserved for possible future comparisons. 3 years on, nobody has ever publicly established whose it was. His petition calls it clumps of hair, not language from the filings, from the broken plea book. That he thinks proves his innocence. The honest answer is we don't know what it proved because nobody finished the actual work. What's your take on this, Jen, on the clumps of hair? Is this something that can be very quickly explained and okay, that's great. Isn't that cute, Brian? You came to us with this. Here's your answer. Go back to yourself.
Well, no, I can't be easily explained because they're going to have to do a lot of work to get the DNA. Secondarily, I mean, he has thrown his biggest advocate and somebody who, you know, I got to admit it. I mean, it was $5.5 million that went to her team.
Yeah.
So she had other motivation, but I have never seen somebody so zealously represent somebody. And I mean that seriously.
Yeah.
She would have three experts when only one was needed. I think she had four experts maybe when it came to the genetic genealogy when she was trying not to have that put in, something like that. It was outrageous. The media, when she wanted the media out, she had three experts there do charts and graphs, and it was unbelievable what she did. She was a zealous advocate of his. So I think he's going to be hard pressed. Having said that, why is anybody surprised? It's funny. I put out a tweet about this right when he pled. I said, this is all in the plan. This is his plan. There was no way he was going to sit there. He bided his time for the right time when things had kind of softened down. And here he comes again out with the reveal. And I don't think anybody who really has followed him closely is at all surprised about this. And my only thing is, and I know this is insidious, if I tell you, if there isn't great documentation by Ann Taylor about everything she did that counterpoints what he is alleging, man, I will just really be shaking my head if you get where I'm going there.
Yeah.
And I...
Are the T's crossed and the I's dotted?
And it, well, as I understand it, because I remember when Broken Plea first came out and I made the true attempt to read it and put it down because it was pretty unreadable. Yeah. And I explored it, you know, because I explored it. And I remember, I think we talked about it with Bob and even Eric Faddis at the time. And that is the claims are just dumb because it wasn't part of the process yet. In other words, he pled guilty based on everything they've been through so far, which was a lot. It was overwhelming. And Ann Taylor was working. I mean, we all agree. We were scared she was going to do her job better than anyone else because she was really his advocate. And then he pled guilty before they could even process anything else in the file, anything, any of the other evidence, including debris in hands. And so it wasn't that it was done and overlooked or it was excluded. No, it hadn't been part of the process yet of the investigation of the trial because it didn't get that far because everything else prior to that was already overwhelming that he pled guilty to. Then he stood in front of the judge three times, asked, did you do this? Yes. Did you do this? Yes. Did you do this? Yes. To all the murders, did you get good counsel? Yes. Did you get good? I mean, it was so thorough. I mean, they did such a good job. And again, the claims made in the book that he's resting his laurels on, to my knowledge, not being a lawyer, listen to our lawyers say that it just isn't legitimate because it didn't reach that point yet where they would do that extra investigative work on it. So he's just barking in the wind because, you know, like we said with Rex Heuermann, I know I said it the other day, Rex Heuermann's using information as his only currency. So if he's got more bodies out there, as he gets bored and people aren't paying attention to him, he's going to start trickling out more information like Dennis Rader did, and like all these people that are narcissistic, self-centered, megalomaniac asses do, that they're going to trickle this stuff out. Since Koberger didn't have time in his short, pathetic life to kill any more people, he's spent his information currency, so he's going to be getting attention any other way he can. I tell you what, as people start ignoring him, please ignore this freak. You know, the one thing we might eventually get as he gets older and more bored and doesn't get the right bananas that he wants in there is that we might finally figure out, and he might start trickling some areas maybe to look for where he secreted a knife, maybe where his clothes wound up, maybe how he took that car apart so thoroughly. So if you just ignore him, we might actually get a little bit more.
Great point.
I guess my fear on some of this is what was going on with the prosecutor's office. Where, you know, how were the T's crossed and the I's dotted there with Bill Thompson, who we've affectionately referred to as Santa Claus several times on the program? Yeah. You know, we never saw him in action other than, you know, the statements that he's made, that the case never went to trial. I honestly have felt I was not super feeling confident about Bill Thompson and where this was going to go and how strong of a case he was going to make. Not because the case isn't strong, but because I don't think Bill Thompson has the reps to do a case like this as effectively as Ann Taylor did. We're going to go back into this, I guess. We're going to take a look at some of this stuff. Where does it go from here? With these hairs that are, you know, or the debris, we should be clear. The verbiage was debris. If it is hairs, I guess it's hairs. Are they going to go test these because Koberger's making a stink? Or is it like, we don't have to do shit. You can do all you want. You can, you know, bang your head against the wall and hit the pots and pans. It doesn't matter. You've already pled. It's game over. We don't have to go investigate anything here. I guess what sort of levers does Brian Koberger have to pull here?
He has one lever, only one under Garza. All he can do is show ineffective assistant of counsel. That's the only ticket to get a new trial. Oh, hairs, wow, and all this other stuff, it's not going to do it. And I would believe if she did her job right, which we know how competent she was,
yeah,
she should have documented all of that, exactly what was given to him, that he would have known about the debris, you know, that he had the full case file. And that covers her for in terms of what she discussed with him. Remember, he's accusing her of like making up stories of what it would be like in prison to convince him and coercing him. I mean, that's what he's saying. I find it absolutely nauseating that we are believing one word Brian Koberger says. But your point, Tony, is does it matter? And I don't believe it does at all unless they can show ineffective assistance of counsel. And I can tell you, if Ann Taylor doesn't have that documented, that would be stunning.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, and I also, in the last week, I watched the Idaho Murders College Nightmare, the Netflix special on it, which really focused on the victims, the families, the Gonzaleses. And it's a great show because, to the point, and I agree, the prosecutor didn't fill, you know, Santa Claus didn't fill your heart with the confidence and everything. And I thought this early on when I watched some of the video footage of the Moscow Police Department showing up on, like, I think a couple of weeks ahead of time with a noise complaint or something, and how those law enforcement officers interacted with the students. I was really impressed. And when you watch that special, same thing. I was very impressed with, you got a very small department with the Moscow PD, and I thought they did the investigation very, very, very well. The leadership internally I thought was very impressive. It wasn't chaotic. It was very structured. They didn't have a huge lot of experience, but they knew how to deploy what they could. They knew how to partner with people, and I think they worked very good with the prosecutor's office. In other words, very rarely in life do you have everyone firing at 100% or 110%. So when one person's falling maybe a little bit short, you got the other one taking it up because they're doing a great job. And I think Moscow PD did, my props to them. Very rare that we can say a police department in one of these cases did a great job. I really think they did.
One of the questions that gets thrown out here, and it's the first thing that ran through my mind, was, okay, because if we're going to go back to what the thing Koberger's arguing is that he wasn't told about the handful of debris. Ann Taylor can have done her job, you know, stunningly in every other lane. But if he wasn't told about that, and it was, you know, basically phrased in the book as it was some sort of, you know, exculpatory evidence, I don't know that it really truly is at the end of the day. There's a thousand things that point to Brian Koberger. But people are going, why did Ethan have a handful of anything? Wasn't he killed in bed while he was laying there? Didn't even really know what was happening until it was too late. I saw one of the comments said Stephen Christie Gonzalez talked about this. They said that his hand slipped behind the bed and touched dust bunnies. I mean, I can see that. I guess that does make somewhat amount of sense. But we don't really know for sure. I guess why does he have a handful of anything to begin with? I mean, it feeds the conspiracy, folks, and that's where I'm like, okay, well, what's the answer to that? Why would he have a handful of that? Maybe that's the answer. What do you think?
I love that answer. It was funny. I was just looking for a set of car keys, and I reached up on this shelf that I hadn't been on. I mean, there's hair. There's dust bunnies. There was a cobweb. I'm like, I was just looking for my car keys, but because nobody has, or these car keys, because nobody has been up there. I mean, and under a bed, and just imagine the hair and everything that could accumulate. I mean, I don't want anybody looking under my bed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a place people don't clean as thoroughly as they probably could. I agree with the Gonzalez family. And then beyond that, there are all of these documents are bait stamp, B-A-T-E-S. They're all what we call baits. So there are particular numbers that are assigned to everything in that file, everything. And so there's going to be a record that Ann would have made about what baits went to him, baits 1 through 20,000. And then I sent the whole disk with these terabytes on this date. This is something that's, and I know when you talk to Bob, he can verify this, that this is something that as a defense attorney, it's defense attorney 101. Just like prosecution 101, I'm going to keep track what I give to the prosecutor because my prosecutor isn't doing that because I'm giving the evidence.
As the
mope working the case.
And here's an important thing to keep in mind, I think, for everyone that thinks this is something big. So Koberger is basing everything that he's doing, because if you look at the language, it's cut and paste directly from the book Broken Plea. So let's look at where Broken Plea came from. Broken Plea came from a very retired FBI agent from years ago who never worked homicides inside the FBI, who got this from one of the people that worked for Ann Taylor that had signed a non-disclosure, broke the non-disclosure, and handed over files to this to the author of Broken Plea, didn't conduct interviews, didn't conduct anything. So this is all hearsay from a file given by someone who wasn't allowed to give it in the first place. So take it all with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I agree. My concern is if there was an over... I mean, what happens? What happens if Koberger did not get the baits on this? What if he did not, for whatever reason, and I'm not saying anything nefarious or that Ann Taylor intentionally withheld anything, but, you know, human errors happen. Sometimes the files don't get where they're supposed to go. Does he have a leg to stand on if he says, well, I never had that information when I made this decision, and they can prove he never had that information when he made that decision? I mean, human error can restart shit. Would this do that, even if it's shown that he didn't have it? I mean, we don't know the answer to where it goes, though, right now.
Well, I think it's the totality of proving that a lawyer gave ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah.
That is something that is a pretty high bar, considering he's convicted, to go over.
Sure.
I don't even think that would be enough. I know Bob will probably know that answer better than me, but I can't think of one case that I ever worked that got to the appeal stage where something like this was thrown up at the wall and it ever stuck.
Yeah. Yeah, you just, you don't know. I mean, crazier things have happened. You know, that's the, who would thought we're going to have Alec Murdaugh trial number two?
Well,
you know, I mean, it's a different total dynamic, but it, you know, it's like stranger things have happened, you know?
So here's the here's the legal standard for it. Under the Supreme Court Strickland versus Washington test, the defendant must prove two things: deficient performance, that the lawyer's work fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, basically not that no competent attorney would have done what they did. And the second is prejudice, that there is a reasonable probability the outcome would have been different if the lawyer had performed competently. So it's an extremely high bar. It's an uphill battle, unlikely.
It'll be fascinating to watch, and I hope it goes nowhere and Brian Kobert can go back to his cage. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's go and talk about another case that we continue to follow. The medical examiner who performed Nolan Wells' autopsy, Dr. Stacy Turner, Mississippi's chief medical examiner, has a few skeletons in her closet. Ruled a previous in-custody death undetermined, despite her own findings documenting neck injuries consistent with deputy compression. Three independent pathologists reviewed the same evidence, called it a homicide. A grand jury used Turner's ruling and closed the case. One of the deputies at that arrest, Hunter Elward, was never charged. He walked free until federal prosecutors caught up with him and for something else entirely. Elward was part of the Rankin County Goon Squad, a group of deputies who broke into a home, assaulted two black men, shot one of them in the mouth, and tried to cover it up. Federal charges, federal convictions, federal prison. Same sheriff's department, same deputies, and the medical examiner who helped them avoid accountability for the first death is the same one sitting on Nolan Wells' sealed autopsy right now. Great. Great. We again, this is just kind of like, you know, the people you put in places of power, if they have track records like this, let's not you know, go into adding curiosity or conspiracy where there doesn't need to be. But I understand why there would be some curiosity and people wondering of conspiratorial thoughts, considering the track record of Mississippi. I'm not saying that that's what's going on here, because we, the end of the day right now, we just don't know the answer to that question. I'm not saying his friends had anything to do with it. I personally don't feel like they did. But it's optics. Optics matter. Optics are important. Why is this person the chief medical examiner still for the state of Mississippi with this sort of shit behind her? Jen, how do you think that affects this case?
Not good. Look, Giglio Brady. Giglio Brady exists for a reason. And what that is to say is, whether it's a law enforcement officer or an ME, if you have issues in your past, anything that even rubs in the direction of not being forthright in your findings, which that case did, right? Yeah. I mean, it was convenient. Wasn't it convenient that it was just undetermined? That's always a convenient. When I'm always with the ME going, don't give me undetermined. Just give me what it is. But, you know, a lot of it, we saw it in the Karen Reed case, undetermined.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It just messes everything up for everybody, because you have an ME that can't make a decision. In this case, or in that case, I mean, that was a bad situation, and I can't believe she is the one. Is she the one, though, that performed it, or the one?
Yes.
Performed it.
From what I understand,
I could be wrong,
but from everything I've absorbed, that's where my mind is at this moment. I mean, this is obviously, there's so much stupidity here with the local law enforcement. The sheriff immediately coming out, we don't think it was this. You don't even have any evidence to say either way yet. Shut the fuck up. And then when you do have the body, you pick the person that's got this track record and this skeleton in her closet coming along. Gee, nobody's going to question that shit. I mean, what?
Tony, poor Tony's off the rails. Okay, Tony, a couple of things. She might just be the chief and they have put her in an administrative role more,
yeah,
you know, she an overarching role, but she didn't precisely perform the autopsy.
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen that report and I don't think it's out there.
It's not.
So because of that, we don't know who was the hands-on person cracking the chest, cutting everything open, weighing all the parts, doing all the work. We really don't. She signs off on it. Typically, that's how it works. Yeah. You don't have the chief performing the autopsy. I'm hoping that's the case here. I'm hoping she's more of an executive role with her hands on anything anymore. I'm not saying that mitigates a wrongdoing she did in the past. I'm just saying, as long as this was done by somebody else and it's their decision, I think that it will look much better.
And also, I'm just hoping still that there's congruency between that medical examiner and the independent one. You know, I'm hoping that there's congruence here. I'm hoping with all the effort they're making to dig out everything from cell phones to GPS data to examining everything, that everything just keeps coming up to tragic accident and not something much worse and darker than that.
Credibility is going to be everything here. So I'm not, and I'm not saying that she got anything wrong. I don't believe she was, she wasn't criminally found wrong with anything that she did in the past either. It's just, here's what happened. And here's the case that, that she was involved with. And here's how it turned out with the goon squad. And it doesn't look good. So I'm not saying that she did anything wrong here, but even if it was done by the book, perfect, she's the one, her office is the one who has the neck, who has the piece that nobody has the answer to. The independent autopsy doesn't have the neck. And I understand this is how it works. They typically, you can only unpeel an orange once. And they have that part. But when you have this appearance of impropriety in the past, and you're the one that holds that information, even if it does come out and says, well, we got nothing here, or inconclusive, and that doesn't show anything, nobody's going to believe it. And rightfully so, even if it is accurate. I mean, it just seems like such a setup for failure when you're trying to get to the truth, if that's the goal at the end of the day for all these agencies. And I hope to God it is. I'm not saying that she's any sort of conspirator in this, trying to cover anything up. But my God, optics matter. And it just feels like there's so many of these agencies we've seen recently that seem to forget that they serve the public and that the public listens to what they say and their words and their decisions matter. Why is this such an elusive thought to people in these positions?
I'm going to push back a little bit on this whole autopsy thing because they have the skin.
Yeah.
They have specifically said there were no contusions, there's no lacerations, there's no bruising, there's none of that. There is the red part on the back of the head, which I still, and I posted a picture, I don't know if you saw it, showing where that body would rest. Yes, the blood isn't circulating, but the blood pools, there's lividity. There's
and that makes sense, and that's there, but it's this part, it's the neck.
Right, but they had that.
But the office that has it has this history.
Oh, no. So they have it. They don't have the interior.
Yeah.
So you would have expected to see strangulation marks, bruising, but none of that was there.
Okay.
No blunt force of any nature on that body.
On the skin. They just have the muscle.
Right.
Okay.
They have the skin, you know, which is the largest organ in our body.
Okay.
So they have that they've examined and they've said nothing there. But it's just so interesting how I think when they presented the independent autopsy, which, first of all, number one, the person who did the autopsy conveniently didn't want to talk about it because or wanted to, you know what I mean? It wasn't good for their side for him to come out. That's really who we needed to hear from because Crump can't even. Because it would have been better for our understanding.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting how they cherry picked. Oh, but you know, this was gotten this. We all know that. But if you don't have bruising here, how can your larynx and your trachea be affected? You can't just go under the skin. So to me, they just kind of sort of keep out those important facts.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, it's going to go to the grand jury. Everything's sealed until it does. I think the likelihood the grand jury is going to recommend, you know, moving to trial, I think it's high probability just because of everything that's going on. And so I think everything will come out there.
But you need somebody, though. You
Did
need
you to. Say you think it will?
Only because of all the noise. I don't.
But who are they going to point at? That's the thing.
Well, I think they're going to go on a fishing expedition because I'm just getting that tenor of this. Because when you see the level that people are going to dig up, that's why I'm kind of smiling over. Is like, of course they're finding out that there's an incongruency here or behavior here. Because, but I always look at this. How long did it take them to figure that out? I mean, because you've had so many eyes poking at this for so long. So I think it comes down to this. It comes down to Crum and his guys. How much can they put? They want it to go to trial. They want a trial. That's You know they do. They don't want it. They want a trial. So I think it's going to come down to what can they dig up? What can they poke at? And it, between now and the grand jury, can they find someone to poke at to put it on them? That's what I think they're doing.
Go ahead, Jen.
No, I was going to say the grand jury, in my opinion, is going on now. How right. The grand jury typically works is literally as you get evidence, you bring it in, you sit there for 15 minutes and then you leave and then you go the next day. And as things come in, you present over and over and they take it all in. There is no suspect.
I agree.
The people that have had a finger pointed at them, they're suing. Yeah. I am pulling bravo.
Yep, I agree.
I agree.
To align these kids. Without a scintilla of evidence, there is not a scintilla of evidence. I've listened to that damn tape over and over and over again, where they're making up. They said Nolan. P.S. Nolan wasn't even on the boat. We have the pictures, and we have a sighting of him at 4:30. I think it was on the beach. So how was he on the boat at 4 when the call came in? It's all total lies. You can listen to it. It's because somebody said, "Oh my God." Yeah, they were taking on water and the boat was sinking. That's a good reason to say, oh, my God. You think this kid is going to be calling up to, hey, he's obviously impaired. He's like, yeah.
Yep, I know. I listened to it.
Boat towed. Oh, I got a dead body on it.
It wasn't congruent to covering up a murder. Like that call was not that. I mean, that was not what that sounded like. It sounded like a dopey kid who had too many White Claws and probably sounds fairly dopey on a good day. But that's that age. You know, again, that's everybody's young and dumb once. He's living his young and dumb life. You know, but it's, I agree there. How much of this is going to be determined by the digital evidence at the end of the day, meaning Snapchat coming back and saying either they say somebody deleted stuff off of this or there just is nothing that ever went on. Like he wasn't using his phone. That's why there's nothing there. I mean, if it comes back and it shows that shit was deleted off his phone, then you got a case. But if there's nothing that comes back that shows anything was deleted, is that kind of put this dead in the water if you don't have any other like physical evidence pointing to any sort of conspiratorial murderous behavior amongst these people?
Well, I think it's going to be way broader than snaps being erased because snaps erase on their own. And again,
but Snap will tell you whether that's what happened or not. That's
right.
That's,
yeah. It'll tell you, but how about this? I'm out drinking. I'm doing a line of cocaine. I'm with my buddies. And then I'm like, I'm not putting this on there. I mean, that's my reason why I don't think there was anything on there. But your point that you're trying to make is this. What if there is something nefarious in the whole digital realm, which remember could be everything from, let's get Nolan or geez, something negative like that, something that shows something. So if you look at the whole digital spectrum, that's what they're going to look through. And certainly if there is nothing on the digital spectrum, which could be so many things, right? They're talk about who's fishing is, the family, right? They're fishing. They've trying to go after all the kids' social media, all their TikToks and all of this. So nevertheless, Tony, that's just one factor. I think the medical examination, look, what if he OD'd? Nobody's even throwing that out there as a possibility. Listen, this kid is nothing but a great kid from everything I've seen, but I think they were all out there partying. And look at the vibes. Mistakes are made. I'm not saying that's what was made. I'm saying you got to consider it. And could that be the reason why after the autopsy, because I let everybody know, the day that that autopsy was done, which was right after the event, the detectives were there. Mm-hmm. I went to all mine. You're right there, because you're literally asking, what do I got here, doc? Am I looking at an accident? What am I looking at?
Yeah.
So, and I would think also, because the parents are claiming that there was things deleted from Nolan's phone, and to the point that we're talking about on the digital investigation going on right now, I would think in order for that to hold weight, so even if they could say that, that would mean that you're either going to see a lot of things that went sideways that they're going to use on an investigation from everyone else's digitals, or there's going to be a lot of deletions on everyone else's phones as well. And right. We haven't had any leakage that anyone else's phones have had deletions or anything else. I mean, and you, again, there's so many people involved with this. And that's why I'm actually pleasantly surprised there's not more leakage, that things are amiss, that there's a riot, yeah. There's incongruencies. I mean, when you have that many people, the more people you involve, the much less chance of conspiracies, because people will talk and they fight back when they're wrongly accused, like the one kid is doing that. Good for him. But I would think that's the way it was going to be with the digital stuff.
We're in a month now. I mean, we're pretty close to a month now since this horrific, you know, whatever it was that happened where Nolan lost his life took place. I would think that if there was anything to leak out, if somehow that this group of friends is really secretly Klan members and they were ready to, you know, off their friend on the boat when they were out partying one day, I think we would have heard about it by now. I think somebody would have leaked that. We don't see anything of that sort that has come out. I know, like, there's been people over the weekend, like, be brave and share what you have. Yeah, if you have something, share it. If it's something, yes, be brave if it exists. But just saying be brave doesn't mean there's anything to share. Doesn't mean there's anything actually there to begin with. Does somebody who has something to do with something horrific like this open up a civil lawsuit against people? I mean, the civil suits, you have a hell of a lot more leeway to investigate phones, subpoena people, depose people. There's all sorts of shit you can do in a civil lawsuit to really get to the nitty gritty of what's being accused here, what some people are doing against these kids. If you have something to hide, I don't think you're necessarily opening up that door on a legal level to do that. But that appears to be what one of the friends is doing, to say, come at me, go for it, I'll see you in court. That doesn't seem like a guilty person to me. How about you guys?
Yeah, I agree. And if you look at the statements that have been given by these kids, they're coming forward without legal representation.
Yeah.
They are really putting themselves out there, and their parents are allowing that. And it's for a reason. And I think it's because they have nothing to hide.
Yeah.
And I think they've come off very honest. But I did want to caveat one thing. I watched very closely the origination of these things were erased. And the mother actually says that they are not, that he normally takes videos and snaps and they weren't there. It is the attorney Crump that exacerbates that, says, see, they were erased.
Yep.
So that was the metamorphosis, what from really the mom said to, you know, the public outcry and belief that things are erased. So I don't think we're going to find anything erased, but we'll wait and see.
We'll see. Yeah. I mean, we just don't know the answer to that. And once we have the answer to that, it is what it is. I mean, these tech companies don't have a dog in the fight. They're going to come out and say what they're going to, what it shows. And we'll see how everyone responds. We'll keep following this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We would love for you to weigh in. Jennifer Coffendaffer, Break the Case, is her podcast. Get it wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Just search Break the Case, Jennifer Coffendaffer, and you will find that. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books, an audiobook. Leave a review there on Amazon. Much appreciated right there. All right, that's going to wrap it up for today. Until next time, for Jennifer, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs. I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Ahora en McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken Meal Deal o un $6 McDouble Meal Deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu Meal Deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.